How will our aging population affect the homes we have now and the homes we build in the future? Daniel Cerda is director of the Kansas City Design Center. He presented the challenges to planners and developers of our aging population during a meeting of the KC4 Aging In Community on December the 11th, 2009. And he joins us on the Bioethics Channel. Daniel, what was your key message today?
Well, I think the primary message is that home is critically important to all of us. We know that. We invest in our homes. We talk about the financial importance of our homes. The federal government supports our investment in our homes. But the bigger point that I made was that the value, the real value of our home, is basically a social value. It's a cultural value. It's the value that it provides in that very definition of home, of being, you know, where the heart is, where family is, where your intimate social relationships, both with your family members and your neighbors, resides. And the idea is that when it comes to aging in community, it's that ability to be in your house, the security of knowing that you can be there, that you can do what you need to do, that literally the house isn't falling down around you, and that there's security in your neighborhood that's really critically important to people's well-being and sense of their own health.
But how we've built these homes in the past, how we're building them now, how we build in the future, that's going to have to change, won't it?
Absolutely. That's one of the key points that I made. One of the things that I did is I walked through a sequence of images of the typical houses that many of our neighborhoods are made of. I often make the point, I didn't say it in this talk, but I often make the point that if you think about Kansas City really is essentially even the urban area, a collection of a lot of suburban communities of different periods. So what we call the urban core neighborhoods, those were the suburbs of the 1880s or the teens and the 20s. What we consider the inner ring suburbs now, those were the far edge suburban communities like Mission, Roland Park, Overland Park of the 1940s and 1950s. And then the new suburban communities out of the edge will probably be looked at in the same way in the future. There have been different housing types that have dominated each of those neighborhoods. Recent suburbs have had a lot of ranch houses. Back in the early 20th century, you saw a lot of sort of neo-colonials and then bungalows. And again, those are all part of the vital neighborhood fabric. Housing stock ages along with people, and so upkeep is always an issue, but so is the scale of the house. And along with the scale of the house, you have to think about the financial burden of the house.
When you say the scale, how many bedrooms, as an example?
How many bedrooms, how many square feet, how many bathrooms? That becomes, that's a challenge over the course of your life. You know, everyone buys into a house usually fairly early in life when you're planning to have a family. So you need three bedrooms because you're going to have one for yourself, one for your kids, especially as they get older. Probably want more than one bath, though that would have been an unrealistic assumption 80 years ago. It's a very commonplace assumption today. That set of assumptions grew and frankly exploded during the 1980s and 1990s as homes in relative terms became more affordable because interest rates dropped. It became easier to borrow to buy a home. To the point that, we had a typical house in terms of expectations for somebody buying into an outer ring suburb, on the order of 2,500 to 3,500 square feet. One of the questions that I was raising today is that sustainable going forward? It's not going to be practical for an elderly couple 30 years down the line to be living there. But by the same token, is it really something that we should have been doing? Is it something we're going to continue doing in the future? And so one of the things we'll need to look at is some alternative housing models, not just the obvious examples like condos and lofts that have been proposed for what we often refer to as empty nesters, that is childless couples or couples whose children have grown up and moved away, but alternative models that are rooted in neighborhoods and that work well with providing that important social network and support structure.
A common theme with all the presentations today was the impact of the car, the vehicle, and that transportation that's required in the interstate setup and such and so forth. Is Kansas City unusual in that regard?
Oh, absolutely. Kansas City has more freeway miles per capita than any other metropolitan area in the country.
Really?
We are bound to our automobiles as a result. One of the points that I made in my talk is that it's kind of a strange anachronism to see because we have in Kansas City one of the premier examples of how to design for the car and not have the car designed for us. And that's the Country Club Plaza. J.C. Nichols thought a lot about this wonderful, marvelous technology of the future back in the 1920s when owning a car was the new novelty. I've described it to my students as being like owning an iPod or something like that today.
Okay.
That's what it would have been like back in the 20s to be able to afford a car. And Nichols was thinking about how to accommodate an automobile. And, of course, we all love the Plaza because it's so friendly and pedestrian accessible and
walkable. And for those who may not be familiar with Kansas City, the Plaza is a restaurant, a retail community.
Exactly.
To some degree,
it's,
right?
It's primarily a retail district, but it is surrounded by a range of different housing types for everything from very dense, very tall apartment buildings to more modestly scaled apartments to very large, well-appointed single-family homes. It is near the geographic center of the community. That makes it attractive to people from throughout the region. But it's really the experience of the place, the walkability of the place, the variety and the diversity of what you see on the street. It's a place to see and be seen. And the point that I made was that we have this wonderful tradition of thinking, again, how to plan for the car, not have the car plan for us, that we absolutely seem to have lost. We lost that sensibility in most of what we've done in the last 20 to 30 years. We've really let cars plan for us, so much so that it is nearly impossible in not only suburban communities but even some parts of the urban community to be mobile, to move from place to place without being behind the wheel of an automobile.
And it's the idea of being able to get to the mall, being able to get to church, maybe getting from one neighborhood to the other. They're all just kind of isolated
exactly.
in pieces, right?
Well, and it's not just movement between places. Obviously, over long distances, most people are going to want to drive. One of the things that's really important in transportation policy is the growing recognition that a lot of traffic congestion and a lot of the air pollution associated with cars, and frankly also a lot of the accident risk associated with cars, comes from the fact that the majority of our trips are very short. They're less than 2 miles in length. And again, we take it to the absurd extreme here. I gave the example in my presentation today of what we call power centers, which are the retail centers that have two or three large anchor stores, often a Target, Lowe's, Home Depot, something along those lines, Super Walmart. And, you know, anyone who's been to one of those places knows from your own experience, if you're going to go from the Target to the Bed Bath and Beyond, you're going to get in your car and drive from one end of the parking lot to the other. So even within neighborhoods, even within those developments, we have made ourselves entirely auto-dependent, frankly, to a higher degree than most other metropolitan areas have.
So how should we rethink this with the idea that by 2030 we'll have this influx of baby boomers? You and I will be
exactly.
dominating the demographics.
Well, one of the most important things to remember is that we're not going to wait until 2030 to do this. We have to start doing this now. And frankly, we're already starting to do this now. In retail in particular, we have such an overabundance of retail that there are now in entering suburbs and even in some large, otherwise fairly thriving suburban communities, there are retail spaces that have been emptied out. Those are really critical opportunities for thinking about physical redesign and redevelopment of those spaces. They're not serving a viable economic use right now, many of them, not only because of the economic downturn, but because, frankly, our retail market is somewhat oversaturated. So the question is, how do you use those as opportunities to overplay an analogy, to sort of tighten the knit of the fabric of the neighborhoods around them? Some of this is going to require working through some challenges. People are going to have to start recognizing that there might be an advantage, not a disadvantage, to having commercial development near where you live. That's something that has driven a lot of our decision-making over the last
2 years. Not in my backyard.
Not in my backyard, trying to keep it far away. There are advantages to it. There are models for how it works. There are design concepts to how to make it work that are out there. And that's part of the thinking we're trying to introduce here and the conversation we're trying to start. But again, the big point is we're not going to wait till 2030 to do this. We need to start thinking about doing this now. I often make the point to planners that planners often make very long-range plans, 20, 30-year, 50-year vision plans. And somehow we perceive ourselves as being the same age in 20, 30, or 50 years that we are today. And
it's amazing how that works, huh?
Exactly. But, the argument that I make, though, is think about it from the perspective of your own self-interest, because in 20, 30, 40 years, one of the things we heard today in one of the other presentations was that sometimes it's not the drive that's the problem as you get older, because many people retain their ability to drive and to drive safely into their 80s and 90s. It's the ability to be mobile once you have to get out of the car. You know, are you going to be able to move from place to place? Again, as I mentioned before, that's why you drive from the Target to the Best Buy, because it's impractical to move around otherwise.
One of the things that you talked about was the walkability within neighborhoods and just seeing different sidewalks, different curbs, different things like that. And I assume that we're going to have to do more of that.
Oh, absolutely. We have problems with disinvestment. And one of the consequences of disinvestment is that a lot of the basic infrastructure, especially in inner city neighborhoods, has been neglected. So you have circumstances where the concrete in the sidewalks is broken apart, or the sidewalks are 80 years old and they're still actually paved out of brick, and you have trees growing near the street and the roots are, you know, causing the bricks or even the concrete to heave, and that creates trip hazards. We have older areas that need to be retrofitted for more pedestrian-oriented features, very simple traffic control features like signalized pedestrian crossings or curb cuts that need to be placed, not only for those who are disabled, but for those who have limited mobility. You don't want to create a trip hazard at a corner crossing that's going to cause someone who might have an issue with their balance or their gait or actually be using a cane or something like that. They're going to fall down and get hurt.
This sounds like, to make this transition, it will have to be very meticulous. It will have to be very carefully done in an environment that's probably politically challenging.
Oh, absolutely. There was a question today about how we're going to pay for all of this. Mm. And I think there are two points to make about that. One is we spend an inordinate dollar amount in resources. I think the number we heard today was $1 billion per year as a region on transportation needs. I can tell you from looking at the numbers and direct experience, a tiny, tiny fraction, I believe it's less than 2% of that, goes towards pedestrian-oriented needs. Most of that is to pave highway miles or to build additional lanes or to build traffic interchanges on interstates. That's incredibly, incredibly costly. So it might seem daunting to have to do a laundry list of a lot of little things. But the fact is those little things individually are nowhere near as expensive as some of the big choices that we've made that have created the dilemma that we're in.
Daniel Cerda is director of the Kansas City Design Center. For more information about the KC4 Aging in Community Initiative, go to practicalbioethics.org. That's practicalbioethics.org. I'm your host, Laurel LeBoux. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.